Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
Welcome everybody to Nightlight. My thanks to Ken Quiethawk for his amazing intro, as always. Please check him out on the internet under Native Storytellers. He and his wife are preserving history in their own unique Native American way, and it's something that you should listen to and learn from, because spoken history predates written history and is often even a lot more accurate. So tonight, this is a very exciting show for me because this is material that has not been out there in the common flow of information, and it's fascinating to me, and so I hope you'll hang in there with me because it really is insightful and interesting and thought-provoking. Tonight I have Edmund Marriage on with me, and we'll be talking, delving into the material presented by the Golden Age Project, a part of the Patrick Foundation, which is an independent research network to provide a down-to-earth, common-sense base for all those open-minded people who seek the highest standards of information on human origins, history, and human relations subjects. Edmund is an extensive historical researcher and has revealed a single advanced secular benevolent source for all religions, his Golden Age Project, inspired by the work of Christian and Barbara Joy O'Brien, promotes the recovery of past knowledge in order to resolve many of today's problems. He believes that reestablishing high standards of training and knowledge for all important roles forms a priority in establishing good government and successful social organizations and cohesion. You can find his amazing work after the show, please, at www.goldenageproject.org.uk. And I highly recommend you look at it because it is fascinating material. We're going to be focusing tonight on the origins of Jesus and his twin brother Thomas, and I know that's a surprise to most of you. It was to me too, and how closely they are linked to the British Druids. He has amazing information. It's interesting, it's thought-provoking, and it's insightful, and I highly encourage you to check out the website and listen carefully because there is information here that I'm sure is going to be enlightening and certainly thought-provoking to all of you. Welcome to the show, Edmund.
Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. It's I have to say that I've read the O'Brien book, The Genius of the Few, the story of those who founded the Garden of Eden, and you've been kind enough to share with me some PowerPoints that you've done, And the information is amazing. And I'm so excited that you're here to discuss this information with me. And I know saying that Jesus had a twin brother is kind of a shock to people, but with the background work that you've done and the O'Briens have done, it makes some sense, especially the link to the Druids. And I've often thought that the message of Jesus was very closely linked to and in certainly in congruence with the teachings of the Druids that predate everything almost. So how do we start this? I mean, I think basically we should start out with Mary and her family so that, you know, we can make sense of the fact that Jesus had a twin brother.
Well, thank you. The starting point for the whole project was Christian O'Brien. Christian O'Brien was an incredibly successful exploration geologist. He was the man who discovered oil in Libya. He rewrote the history of the Rocky Mountains. And while he was doing his exploration in the area of Sumer, he found clay tablets on the top of a mound, which later he was credited with discovering as a ziggurat. And the key point here is that he's the only person who has properly translated the ancient cuneiform. Samuel Kramer hoped it would be done in 1926, and O'Brien set about when he retired from the oil industry to translate that cuneiform. Now, by translating the cuneiform, he found that the Sumerians had left a very accurate and detailed record of the Garden of Eden, the place run by the Elohim. Now, the word Elohim we've used for God singular, whereas it is a plural word. And El means bright, and the second part of that word means shining. So we're talking about our own Christians busily worshipping the shining ones, and yet calling them Elohim singular, when in fact it was Elohim plural. And from that work, we've got now a very thorough survey, search, exploration of the shining ones at action and work way back before massive cosmic catastrophe at 10,850. We've also got a second very important avenue opening up, which is Christian O'Brien's discovery of the island of Atlantis. Being one of the world's leading geologists, he was able to go to the Azores and get all the maps from the Portuguese Admiralty and to do all the work needed to prove that the area of the Azores, the area the size of Spain, had sunk catastrophically 3,000 feet on one side, maybe 5,000 feet on the other. And so he proved beyond all reasonable doubt that our ancestors had occupied this very large area of land in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, which was almost certainly destroyed by the movements in the Earth crusts, which followed the cosmic catastrophe in 10,850, which was very large parts of a comet which had exploded in 39 BC, the heavy debris being last to arrive and causing the most damage, and much of the debris coming in over the Hudson Bay, moving the Earth on its axis by 14 degrees, which is what is recorded in the Great Pyramid. And then through the rest of the work that we've been talking about here, he has looked very hard at religion and what Jesus was saying about religion. And then we find that Thomas comes in here, because Thomas clearly appears to be the person who knows Jesus best. He's the person who produced all the early works on Jesus's teachings, and he certainly was there with Jesus way after the crucifixion. The Acts of Thomas in the St. Catherine's Monastery Library makes it very clear that Thomas was having a regular meetings with Jesus in India way back, way on. And Jesus lived to, I think, an age of about 86. And Thomas was there all the time. He knew the most about Jesus. And they really did look, if you look at the historical aspects here, as though they were very closely related. And, of course, the exciting bit's coming, because I'm going to tell you what happened and the story there. Now, we were all led to believe a lot of different things about religion, but it's very important to remember that Jesus was extremely well connected with Joseph Haramathio, who in fact ran the trade routes for the Romans from Rome. And that was done through the court of Herod. And the court of Herod had apartments within the court of Augustus. So Joseph, the guardian of Mary, was extremely powerful and important individual, working very closely with the Herod family and in particular with Augustus. Now, the situation here, it always seems incredulous that somebody should make a claim that they, Jesus and Thomas, are twins. And several very competent historians have raised that particular point and, of course, been rubbished by everybody. But the important point here is that if you read the Talmud, there are seven or maybe eight references to somebody called Yeshua, which is the correct name for Jesus, Y-E-S-H-U-A, Yeshua, Ben, son of Pantera. So this is a very important point, because when we get to Jesus in the temple in Rome, we've got the priests and the hierarchy in Rome being very suspicious of Jesus, because in their own best books, he's described as son of a Roman soldier. And that's why there was so much hostility, or principal reason for the hostility, between the high priests in the temple, who wanted Pilate to get rid of him. Because, as I say, he was not a Jew, 100% Jew. He was 50% Jewish, although his mother Mary was on the line of David. She was very well educated. She was entitled to the fortunes from the Herod family. There was a point here too that hereditary claims pass through the female line in certain areas. But anyway, the point is that it was quite normal for her, as a princess whose grandmother was married to one of the British kings, it's quite normal for her to be right at the heart of the court of Herod and right at the heart of the court of Augustus. Now, in 8 BC, we have a situation, and if anybody reads Alan Massey's wonderful book on Tiberius, they get a lot of clues, because he is the one author, in my opinion, who's really got to grips with what a brilliant soldier and a brilliant man Tiberius was. And later we find Tiberius suggesting to the Senate that Jesus is given a title within the Senate to go along with what was called Pax Romana, and they wanted to give Jesus this title because of all the efforts he made to continue Roman peace. That's what Pax Romana meant. Now, when a very attractive soldier, who is very upset and lonely because his own wife has behaved or he's been set a problem by Augustus. Augustus wanted him to marry his own daughter, Julia, who was a complete nightmare. And Alan Massey describes all this extremely well in his book. But the point was that it was clear that when he returned from his campaign in Germany, he was a pretty unhappy man. And that is where he undoubtedly met Mary. And obviously, like so many people at that time, or even this time, had a fling. And the result of the fling was twin boys, which to Romans was absolutely fantastic, because this takes us back to Romulus and Remus, and we find that Tiberius spent a fortune on restoring the temple in Rome to the two heavenly twins, so to speak. Lots of other clues. Tiberius was being informed of Jesus's every move. He had a wonderful letter from King Abgar V from Edessa, who wrote and said, "I hear you're curing people of illness. I'm not feeling very well. Come and heal me." And Jesus wrote back and saying, "I'll send you one of the disciples, but I've got a lot of work to do, jobs to do, and I've got to report back to he who sent me." That's one of the many clues here of Tiberius having two fathers, a heavenly father and an earthly father. There are other very important clues here, because we find out at the time of the crucifixion, Pontius Pilate was watching very closely what was happening and reporting back to Tiberius. Now, if Jesus had been a Roman, that would be pretty natural, especially if Tiberius was the father of Jesus. But the whole point here is that if he'd been a Jew, he wouldn't have got a look in him. Pontius Pilate wouldn't have been interested. And the key point here I'm making is that Pontius Pilate had no choice but to make it look as though Jesus had been crucified, because he only had 125 Scots Guard soldiers, and we had maybe, I don't know how many, whether it was a million or more people, but in for the festival of the Passover, but an enormous number of people. And therefore, what he did, quite sensibly, in my opinion, was to make it look as though Jesus had been crucified. And we have the record, too, that Jesus was only on the cross for 6 hours. No nails were used. He was tied on the bar, or bars probably, for 6 hours. And he had a sponge given him to refresh his mouth. And he also had apparently a spear put in his side on the lower ribs, which is something that you would do to make sure somebody hadn't got too much fluid in their lungs. And the man who came along to collect the body...
Can I interrupt for a second? Because, you know, everybody, you know, the Bible has reported that there were nails. So where is the information that he was tied on the cross and not nailed to the cross come from?
Yeah, sure. The point is that you have to put yourself in the position of Tiberius Caesar, who took complete charge of the crucifixion. And this is obviously a debatable point, but remember, within 2 or 3 days, Jesus was back right into a normal state of mind and condition and body, and teaching his inner circle of disciples, which consisted of men and women, and imparting the knowledge which is recorded in the Path of Light by the disciple scribes, Matthew, Philip, and of course Thomas. And so we've got a number of factors here which greatly assist us. One other point I would make is that the greatest scholar on Druidry, the Reverend R.W. Morgan, who wrote a book on St. Paul in Britain in about 1880, he made the point that the Sermon on the Mount was pure Druid teaching and philosophy. Very, very important. So here's Jesus arriving in 29 AD at Capernaum on Lake Tiberias now, and he was preaching and teaching Druidism. And we can go back to the twin boys and find that they were incredibly well educated because of their connections with Joseph of Arimathea and Mary. And they immediately went, when Mary was seen to be pregnant, went to the Essenes, and the Essenes were the people who were the locals in that area of Capernaum, and they were the people most likely to support Jesus. And so he went to that support base. And when Mary was pregnant, she took the twin boys to the Essenes. And then we have a situation where Joseph was extremely well prepared to look after her with ships from Caesarea to Alexandria and transport all the things that were available to a man running the trade routes for the Romans. And so we find Jesus and Thomas being educated for over 3 years with Philo of Alexandria, who was a key figure in history and very much a figure, we call him the Pythagorean, but the boys would have learned a great deal from him about good government. And that's what we find many people saying about Jesus. He was really interested in good government. Now, one of the things that happened is when the boys were 12 years of age, and they were coming backwards and forwards to Rome at that time to be educated with Augustus in Rome, Geoffrey of Monmouth, who I believe was an excellent Catholic historian, said he thought that Jesus was in fact Augustus's son. But we find so many coincidences and common statements which can lead us to believe that both Jesus and Thomas were sent by Augustus and Tiberius to be educated in Britain under the Druids, and they were sent to replace two boys who'd been killed in Germany under Tiberius's father. And so they were sent to Tenvantius, who was the very successful king of the Cachalivornae, who was very much involved in trade and business with Rome. And what Jesus did at the age of 16, and Augustus had told them to take Roman weapons with them, he had actually had a peaceful treaty with the Trinovantes, who were based at Colchester. And Jesus made his headquarters at Colchester by combining the Cachalivornae and the Trinovante tribes. And Colchester is Camulodunum, or you can soon change that to Camulod or Camelot. And so what he was doing at Camelot was using a round table, which he would have been advised to do by Philo in Alexandria. And that's the key point about the round table was that was what the Sumerian kings did. They always had round tables. People sat in a circle facing each other. They didn't have two sides of an arguing debate. And then when we had the final treaty with the Roman emperor, who was persuaded to come to Britain in 44 BC with an army, thanks to Jesus having many sons, and one of the sons being a real troublemaker, who tried to persuade Caligula to bring an army, and Caligula's troops ended up by collecting seashells on the beach. But there was very rapidly a treaty between the key figure at that time, and in fact, it says 7 or 11 of the British tribes, but Jesus had been appointed by the Druid Council to the Pendragon King of Kings of the Botanic Isle, because he had so impressed all of them at the very early stage. And so here was a young man, and by the time he was 17, 18, 19, he really knew his stuff, and he was uniting the country and doing all the good things that fell apart when Nero came along and when Roman order completely broke down. And we know what happened to the tribe of Boadicea and her husband, Praustus. Praustus actually left half his kingdom to the Roman emperor. That's how highly respected the Roman emperors were at that point. And then, of course, the administrators in Britain and the people who hated Druids vented their spleen on killing as many Druids as possible and being as badly behaved as you can imagine with Boadicea and their daughters. And everything seemed to turn around at that point. But Jesus had been long gone. Tiberius had wanted him to go to Judea to sort out the problems in Judea, which were a running sore. And they, in the end, they were only resolved by a slaughter from the Roman army. So here we have actually incredible people doing a very good job who didn't pull it off because of the state of the Roman Empire and the attitude of the Roman emperors and the fact that it wasn't a true political system that was ever going to work. So in a nutshell, we have a story where we're actually left with fantastic knowledge about the journeys of the soul and the spiritual knowledge that eluded everybody for so long. And we also can learn so much from what Jesus actually said. He wasn't a miracle maker much. Everybody seems to disguise him or claim he made miracles, but his basic interest was good government, and people should be true to one another. And therefore we have, in reality, a fantastic story, which ends with Jesus and Thomas living to old age and setting up a religion, Church of the East, which lasted 1,000 years, and which Muhammad insisted through fatwas that Muslims respected equally the Church of the East. Another very important point. But history hasn't been kind, as far as religion is concerned, hasn't been kind to the people. And it's always been the source of people killing one another. And I'd just like to mention that 2,000 of the most intelligent monks in Britain at Bangor-on-Dee were slaughtered while the man sent by the Pope sat there in a chair and watched it happen. And then we have Charlemagne beheading 4,500 people, Saxons, who wouldn't convert to Roman Catholicism. They're just two of the stories. But it's been a terrible 2,000 years for the human race. And the sooner people know about these truths and can see what is required, thanks to Jesus, among others, and also Thomas. By the way, Thomas was the patron saint of Masons, and there are images of him holding a set square. And he was an incredibly competent individual, much the same way that Jesus was too, and totally practical. So that's my version of it all. Please look at it and study it, and if we can bring about change and realize that we only want one religion, and that religion should be, as the Druids were, people who believed in peace and not war, no war at all. and they were always doing everything they could to stop people fighting. And you think where we've got to in the last 2,000 years, it's been and still is a disaster. Thank you.
Well, that's an amazing dissertation. It feels though, you know, people are going to question, where does, you know, the element of the virgin birth and the Trinity, where does that come into any of this? I mean, was it the element of they made a religion out of whole cloth, or because his teachings are amazing and his philosophies are amazing, but yet you don't hear a lot of that from any of the churches, any of the Christian churches, for sure.
Well, I think you only have to remember the Synod of Whitby, which is one of the most important situations, where the British Church stood on one side and the Danes from Northumberland and Kent stood on the other side. And the Danish king, Northumberland, passed the casting vote, which dismissed British Christianity and put in its place Roman Catholicism. I've never known anywhere in my life, from medical records or anything else, where there is such a thing as a virgin birth. And I think if we look at so much of the material, we could actually dismiss so much of the church propaganda, which they could get away with going back in time. But I don't think they can get away with it any longer, because it doesn't stack up, doesn't make sense. And so we're looking here and trying to present here a far more sensible story about Jesus, his family, the Romans, everybody else, so that we can get back to the truth. Now, the Druid motto was the truth before the world. Absolutely essential. And it's the same today. We seem to be losing our way on what is the truth. As Pilate said four times to Jesus, what is the truth? That is the Druid statement in a court hearing. And so I don't have any difficulty promoting this particular concept, because I happen to believe in it. And I've done a great deal of work to make sure that I don't make a fool of myself. And so I'll answer any questions from anybody.
Well, there's a great deal of evidence to support the fact that the first Christian church was in Great Britain.
Yes, that's right. I find in my records loads of Catholics who were brilliant men. I mentioned Geoffrey of Monmouth, and then there was Polydor Vergil, who was the wrote a history of Britain for Henry VII, and then Cardinal Baronius, the best of the lot. Now, those three staunch Catholics, and Cardinal Baronius almost became Pope, and they all understood what I'm saying, and they know that Christianity started in Britain. Well, if Christianity started in Britain, who was going to start it? And we're right back to the fact that it was Jesus and Thomas principally, and with the help of their children, many children, Caractacus, who became the key administrator when Jesus went to Judea, a high king. And then you had a lot of family links and contacts there. And Thomas was actually went to take over the territory of the Atrebates at Silchester, when the head of the Atrebates decided to go back to France, because they'd fled originally to Britain when the Romans were sacking France. And the British, in fact, sent 50,000 troops to support the French against the Romans. And they went to the Veneti, mostly, a tribe on the west coast of France who had wonderful ships with probably walrus skin sails and great strength, which could sail and do anything within the Atlantic. And then the worst weather, and the Romans were absolutely amazed when they saw it. So there was a great history of friendship between France and Britain and all those European countries under the Druidism flag. And as I say, it had been around for a long while. I think we can say quite conclusively that the Druid principles and ethics that Jesus expounded so well go right back to what we now know about Atlantis. And so there's another aspect to this whole story.
Well, who were the Atlanteans then?
Who were they?
Who were the Atlanteans? Where did they come from? Because they were highly technological culture from everything that I've read.
Well, a lot's been going on our planet for 100,000, 200,000 years. The brains were big enough to do clever things. There have been lots of different sized brains and people. And certainly Plato's records of Atlantis are very interesting. I'm not saying that Plato knew it all. I think they were far more advanced than we really could possibly believe. One only has to look at the sighting of that large area of land in the middle of the Atlantic and see that it would have been a fantastic climate and harbors, and it would have housed a civilization that certainly could have been as good as anything we've had since. And I mean that. Things come and go, but we have to remember that so much that has been good has been destroyed by disease, by climate change, by people fighting, by all sorts of reasons why civilization fails to really get a strong hold.
Did the Druids not have any records at all? I mean, when you look at the records that were kept by the Essenes, they were preserved in jars and caves, and the Sumerians, of course, had their tablets. Did the Druids not have any sort of written form?
No, they one of the features of Druids was to carry memory and not paper. The other thing, of course, is that there was so much was destroyed when the Roman armies went into Anglesey. There may well have been a lot of records there. What we know from the technological sophistication, standard units of measurement, great knowledge of the stars, from Bodmin Moor, a fantastic observatory, with some in the region 90 very large stone cairns. And my belief is that they would have been able to tell the Egyptians to start building pyramids because there was a great risk of cometary debris coming in at 2300 BC. And we have this cyclical cometary debris issue through the Torrid Stream. And our modern day professors and experts have warned us that you can expect something serious every 2,000 years, and we're due to have cometary debris problems quite soon on the record sheet. The difficulty is that when you totally destroy a group of people because you don't happen to like them or they don't fit into your plans, there's not much you can do about that knowledge. Knowledge is lost. But so many archaeologists and specialists, we're all searching for that knowledge. We all want to know more. We all want to know why was it that the pyramids were built? What do they tell us? Well, they tell us that the Earth was moved by 14 degrees on its axis, and the pyramid is perfectly aligned, north, east, south, west, and the star shafts point to where the two major stars were before the Earth was tipped on its axis and after. The Sphinx compound has recently been shown overwhelmingly to have been very much older than the Great Pyramid, and with water worn sides to that Sphinx enclosure. And it points due east to around about 9,000, 8,000 BC. And the people at that time knew exactly where due east was. It's part of that uncovering the knowledge that existed. The other thing about the Sphinx is that some people feel that it was in fact a cheetah, because a cheetah is a wonderful pet and has all the characteristics of cats and dogs. as I say, then we've got so much happening in the Americas, and my other talk is about the Shining Ones and their sophistication and why they were at Göbekli Tepe when it was extremely cold, and we couldn't farm when it was very cold, and so we had to be hunter-gatherers again. It's a wonderful story. All I can say is I'm loving what I'm doing. If people think I'm wrong, I don't mind, because I'm enjoying it.
Well, that's the most important part of everything. I want to ask you about Stonehenge, though. Was that the Druids, or was that another culture or another society?
Stonehenge is interesting and very important. The whole point about that area was that it was cattle grazing country. And the one thing that people needed was meat, grass to meat. And grass to meat is much the best way of handling the environment. The dung comes out the back of the animals, it creates enormous quantities of insects, it refurbishes the soil and makes all number of plants grow. And it's one of the most interesting subjects at the moment, because we're being told we've got to eat less meat. There's not a scrap of evidence or reason why that is so. And what we actually need to do is learn how to slaughter our meat humanely and properly, and bleed them out properly. And the slaughter process is what's gone wrong. I can't find meat that I would like to eat because it's not been slaughtered properly. But that's another story. But the Druids were on top of all that. They had to move those blocks, which the big blocks came from not very far away. The really interesting blocks are the blocks that come from the area of Pacelli. And they were quite unique. And they were stones, rocks, naturally occurring. Only place in this whole country where you find that type of rock, and they are created by cometary debris impacts, great heat, and that's a very, very important point. And then you ask, why did they take all the trouble to remove those much smaller stones and the big stones to the Salisbury Plain, and then change them from a big circle to a smaller circle? And the reason for that is that Stonehenge was a central meeting point, administration point, headquarters, an education center, and a medical center. And one of the things we've learned about monatomic elements, which these stones are made of, the small ones, is that if you sit in a ring of them, you actually can balance your brainwaves. And if you balance your brainwaves, your body becomes balanced. And your body is brilliant at healing itself. Now, that still hasn't been accepted or talked about much, but it's one of the clues. And of course, why did people come all the way from all over Britain to Stonehenge? What were they doing? It's pretty clear that we had people from all over the continent coming up as a main center. The other point I think is always amazes me is the fact that anybody putting up big stones in a circle with lintels and tongue and mortise grooves, etc., clearly is somebody who had the brain power to put a timber roof on top. And there were two people who did actually make a model roof for Stonehenge. And so my belief was that Stonehenge had a very large roof, maybe a lot of accommodation in that roof, but that was a principal part of the whole thing. And then we look at the, not very far from Stonehenge, we see the cursus. Now, any farmer will tell you that if you've got cattle and sheep and pigs and animals, you bring them in at night, particularly if there's lots of wild animals around, as there were in those days. And so people brought their animals into those areas so the animals could have shelter overnight, or they had water arranged for them there. Then they go out to graze in the day with people looking after them. Now, this happens all over Africa. You can see the remains of similar structures all over the world where people have used grazing animals. And Africans, and particularly the Maasai, they bring their cattle in at night. And if you look at their farms, they have a number of enclosures. So when the cattle come in at night and they've had a full belly, the first thing they do when they come in at night and relax is want to get rid of their dung. And dung is the most marvelous stuff for the fertility of the soil. And that made sure that the areas where they brought the cattle in at night provided beautiful soil for all the vegetable crops and other things that they needed. So most of these issues are resolved by farming principles. And same with Avebury, for example, the whole area was a massive cattle grazing area. And the problem about Avebury was that there was water running there and springs there, but they had to be able to make sure they could store a massive quantity of water when they had their big markets, which meant loads of cattle coming in up each of the avenues. There was an in avenue and an out avenue, taking animals from the Ridgeway or back to the Ridgeway. And so these were all practical farming problems, which any farmer today would recognize if he looked at that big picture to see what people were doing. So they had their meat, they had their sheep, they had their wool, they had a number of farm animals, but also they knew how to manage the land and look after the land. And that's something we have almost forgotten now. We just don't understand the fact that the more grazing animals you have, the more diversity of plants. Very, very important.
Right. But who built Stonehenge?
Sorry?
Who built
I missed that.
Stonehenge?
Who built it? Well,
yes.
the master builders amongst the Druids.
Oh, okay. That's where I was going. Because I truly did, you know, I will always believe that the Druids were responsible for it.
Yeah. The Druids were fantastic people, and they had a hierarchy. We always had these hierarchies, but you had the best possible people running the country. And the point was, there's very little war. Druids was a system which very rarely allowed fighting. If there was two armies lined up, one or the other, it would be a woman druid or a man druid, then they'd say, stop. If you're the leader of that lot, you can come and fight the leader of this lot. And that usually meant neither of the men would fight.
Well, they certainly had a philosophy that has stood the test of time, and it's certainly been passed down teacher to teacher, master to master,
yep.
And certainly the philosophy is there at the core of every religion out there. It's just that there's so much dogma built up on top of the truth that sometimes the truth doesn't even get through.
Well, their motto is the truth before the world. We have a mm-hmm. very solid record of being regarded as missionaries from Sidon in about 3,900. And later on, we're getting people talking about the fact now they realize there was this place at Atlantis, that the Druids were ran the politics and the so-called religion in Atlantis. So we've had it all, but we've had so many natural catastrophes and so many pressures that we've lost so much. That's the point. And then we get a whole lot of amateurs trying to run a country. And I don't need to tell you, if we look back 200, 300, 400 years, the muddle we've been making of everything. We think we're clever.
Well, we've had a number of mass destructions and had to start back from a single cell at least 5 times that they have on record, and we may be slating ourselves for another mass destruction. That's for absolutely sure, because, you know, it's no longer don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. It appears that everybody's throwing out the bath too. So going back from scratch is something we've done before, but I'd hate to think that we're doing it now.
Yeah, we've evolved from a very small core of people. And I think that one of the things that interested me, and I've got it in my other presentation, is that if we're looking at color, color is 0.001 of the genetic makeup. Only more people would realize that. It's utter nonsense to use color in any kind of argument or debate that somebody isn't as good as somebody else. Quite extraordinary, but this is, you know, blind ignorance, I think.
Well, I do thank you so much for all of your information. I'm noticing that we're very close to the end here, and I want to recommend that people absolutely check out your website, and it's www.thegoldenageproject.org.uk. The material there is fabulous, and the books that you have there are fabulous as well. I'm looking very forward to, at a later time, getting into the Shining Ones with you, because I'm fascinated with them, and I think it will make a fabulous show.
Well, I'm thrilled that you've allowed me on. I'm thrilled that you're grasping what in my life have been the most important things, largely because of my good luck in meeting quite exceptional human beings who just weren't being listened to. Oh, they're cranks. But we have to search for the truth. And the Druid motto was the truth before the world. Absolutely crucial.
Absolutely. And finding that truth, and certainly the research that's been done, and the O'Brien certainly did a phenomenal amount of it, is fascinating. As is the Shining Ones and how they created the Garden of Eden, and we will go into that at a later date, because I'm fascinated by all of that material as well.
Yeah, that's incredibly important, because it just shows what they did and the pressure were against them. They knew that sea levels had risen by 200 feet or an amazing amount. And so they had to pick somewhere up in the mountains. And they chose a perfect site, which was just below Mount Hermon, where they had snow melt water to irrigate their crops for the first 6 months of the year. And they had all the building materials. And they had, of course, wonderful cedar forests, which they utilized. And the one Enki was the second in command, and he started the work at Jericho, which is our oldest recorded town. And Enki had to deal with these practical problems like irrigation, lime, and very important. And then we had this very rapid change over a short time from rather primitive round houses to quite sophisticated rectangular houses with plastered floor, lime plastered floor. And we have lime being used for the crops, fertilizing the crops. And if we look at all the agricultural evidence, we find that all the major crops, including maize, all started their lives in that section of the Levantine Corridor, tied to Carthage and Mount Hermon down to Jericho.
Well, it's fascinating information, and we're going to get into that the next time we get together. And if anybody wants to read a good book before that show, The Shining Ones is the name of the book, and you can get it at thegoldenageproject.org. And it's fascinating material, and I highly recommend people check it out. So thank you again, Edmund, first. Go ahead.
It's available as an e-book, too, remember. So you've got e-books, and you've got there will be some soft copy books, but I'm just expanding the library of all what I regard to be the most important books available at very low prices to gather this information.
Well, I thank you so much for being here. We'll send everybody out to get the books because they are fascinating. I want to thank you again so much for being here tonight. And I want to have everybody make sure they check in tomorrow for Mark's show, and then again next Monday for me, and somewhere in between, the Hieronymuses are going to put up a show too. So thanks for being here, everybody, and good night.